We learn from our history in Pennsylvania, even when it's painful. Elizabeth Blair, NPR News.
In Australian Open tennis, Novak Djokovic hit a record-extending 400th Grand Slam match win, defeating Botik van de Zandschulp in the third round today. The victory also marked his 102nd win at the Australian Open. I'm Louise Schiavone, NPR News.
Support for NPR comes from NPR stations. Other contributors include Jarl and Pamela Moan, focusing on civil liberties, foster youth, public radio, and the arts. And the Public Welfare Foundation, committed to advancing transformative youth and criminal justice reforms.
It is a brisk morning here on the Augustana College campus, and you're just in time for a conversation with this week's guest, Kent Pilcher from Estes Construction. I'm Kai Swanson. I hope you'll join us here on WVIK for local radio as it's meant to be brewed. That's on Saturday Morning Live, portions recorded. Well, first and foremost, Kent, let me just say thank you. This is a morning that no sane person should be out and about in, but thanks for coming in this morning.
It's a delight, Kyle. I'm really excited and honored to be here. You know, I listen to your program pretty regularly as I'm out and about on Saturday mornings, along with Wait, Wait, Don't Tell Me, and a few others. And it's always intriguing, and the energy that you exude from your program it brightens my Saturday morning.
You know, I'm always a little bit shocked to know anybody's listening. come in here and I have fun. You know, that's about
it. Well, I can tell that. So I'm looking forward to this.
Well, I am too, because you and I have had a chance to cooperate on a couple of different ventures in the Quad Cities. Your QC creds are unassailable for all the things you do for us. But I want to dive into some deeper topics with you. But I want to start at the very beginning, because there are some things I just don't know. And are you originally from this area?
No, I'm not. I grew up in Iowa, in southeast Iowa, a town called Ottumwa, you may be familiar
with. Oh, yes.
And I'm also a private liberal arts college graduate, as you are, Coe College in Cedar Rapids.
Where my son went.
Oh, that's fantastic.
Yeah,
a Quahog.
Yeah.
And then after that, I went to Colorado and then ended up meeting my wife. She's from Michigan. And we were looking, we both had were employed there for quite a while and decided to come back and after several years and join the family business, a business my uncle started in 1970. So that brought us here, and we've been here ever since.
I was always curious about the origins of the name Estes. What is the connection there?
My uncle's name was Jim Estes.
Okay.
He's since passed, and so he started the company in 1970. He was, it was interesting, the company he worked for, the owner was retiring and he didn't want to sell the business because he didn't want his that particular owner's name carried on. So Jim sort of went to work, started his own business out of necessity, and off we went. So that's how it began.
Okay, I got to ask you some things about Ottumwa. For most people of my generation, there are two great Hollywood references. Of course, Radar O'Reilly was from Ottumwa, and then there's a movie about the Tuskegee Airmen, where one of the great fighter pilots was a native of Ottumwa, Iowa. I have to say, I haven't spent much time there. Tell me some things that were special about growing up in Ottumwa.
Well, you know, it's a town then of about 30,000. It's smaller now, and it was the classic kind of town. It was a thriving little town. Cool downtown area. You know, we'd ride the bus downtown to shop, as many people did in those eras. And it just, you know, you knew we had one high school. It was a fairly large high school because we only had one. I think my graduating class was about 460 people.
Yeah.
So there, it was bigger than it might have seemed, right? But it was a great town to grow up in. Since then, it's had some challenges, as many county seat towns have out in rural areas. And part of that is really kind of leadership. We see some thrive and we see some that don't thrive very well. And a lot of that has been around leadership. But it's, you know, it's become a, it was always kind of a blue collar town. But, you know, it's there's been a really strong community college there, and I don't have any relatives that are there or anything else. My parents passed away some time ago. But so it's it was a great town to grow up in, you know, great place.
And then off to Coe. You know, it warms my heart on this chilly morning that you point out it's a liberal arts education, mm-hmm. right? Because I want to pick on you a little bit there. First off, wanting to know what your major was, but if you're going to be intentional about mentioning liberal arts, what were some of the other courses that you think shaped you?
You know, it was a journey for me. I mean, I had the classic liberal arts experience. I went there. I was a math major, mm-hmm. And I became very good friends with one of the prominent math professors there through being a math major, and who he remained a close friend of mine until he passed about a year and a half ago. I mean, everything. He was a great guy. And but through the course of the journey, and once I got through differential equations, I realized that probably the last couple courses were not going to be for me. Moved to business and economics, which mm-hmm. are where my two terminal degrees were. Uh-huh. But one of the things I enjoyed about liberal arts was I took some history. And my senior year, you'll be proud of me, I think, for this. My senior year, I petitioned the head of the philosophy department to take a senior symposium in the fall. And then I repetitioned in the spring. The senior symposium was on the great philosophers. And so I had no background in philosophy, but I was in both fall and spring. And of all the things I remember, I don't remember much about the business stuff. I remember quite a bit about economics.
Yeah.
But I remember the great philosophers.
Yeah. Well, I want to pick on you that for a little bit, and because I agree, this is very important. But what are some of the things that you, as a business leader today, will sometimes find echoes in your head about those mm-hmm. great philosophers?
Well, you know, it's interesting. The place where I first worked when we went to Colorado, I ended up working construction primarily to make some money. I was headed to graduate school in about 2 years. And the guy I ended up working for was a great entrepreneur. He'd built this business to about 1,000 employees. But he had an undergraduate degree in philosophy and a master's in philosophy.
Wow.
So he sort of took me under his wing. I had some early success, and surprisingly, he took me under his wing. And we would have some really interesting dinner conversations where I was trying to keep up with him about existentialism in particular.
Yeah, yeah.
And, you know, does infinity approach zero or zero? I mean, some of these just bizarre kind of conversations. But I was always playing a little catch-up. But anyhow, that's really what I enjoyed about that, and still look back on those memories very fondly.
Wow. Your reference there reminds me of back when I was in the newsroom here, all the way back in the 80s. Some of my favorite memories were that Don would, if, you know, Christmas Day, we still had to work. There was no automation or anything like that. But there would be times over those holidays where he would just bring friends over to the station, and one in particular was with Jim Leach, he was very good friends with, and to just be a fly on the wall. Mm-hmm. And there were, you know, a couple of us staffers kind of sitting in the break room, you know, trying not to be obvious in our eavesdropping, but just sitting there listening to these guys talk, because they were both liberal arts giants. Don still is, and they could talk about anything. I find it interesting how philosophers and schools of philosophy kind of come in and out of popular imagination. And I think the Stoics are having a moment, and they do get that from time to time. I think they were very impressive to the founders of this nation, and now they're coming back around. So do you have favorite schools or philosophers?
Kind of broadly, it's kind of, there's a tension, a natural tension there between, I like existentialism, but I do believe in a fair amount of spirituality.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm,
so the, I always, that's sort of a tension in your mind. And, you know, I think maybe our liberal arts background, collective liberal arts background, helps us to deal with those kinds of tensions in our mind.
Yeah.
So, and certainly in today's world, you know, you have to manage a lot of those kind of juxtapositions.
Sure. I was privy to a very fun conversation Friday night at the Figgy. The college hosted this, what's called Futurist Thinking Series. And the panel was Tracy Polvorde, the Chancellor of Trinity College of Nursing, Lendl Calder, who is a finalist, one of the top three finalists for the Cherry Award, which is the top teaching award in American higher education. So, I mean, we're very lucky to have him here. And then someone else we're very lucky to have, Judge Tion Fambro Carter from Rock Island County, who happens to be the first African-American female in the 14th Judicial Circuit of Illinois. Mm. And they were talking about these kinds of things. You know, what's the stuff that sticks? And I thought it was fascinating that the one who's probably that most academic cred guy is Lendl. He says, I don't remember anything from undergraduate. Because, you know, the lessons that were most impressive to him were those interstitial ones between mm-hmm. the classes, mm-hmm. right? And that impacted his teaching. But they all had this agreement around the importance of curiosity. Mm-hmm. And I think that's the trick, isn't it? Because it's asked of us in the first third of our lives, and then it becomes optional. Mm-hmm. And you can see a real difference between the people who lean in versus lean out.
You know, I think that's a really interesting point because if I think about anything about the liberal arts experience, it is exactly the way you narrated it, around mm-hmm. curiosity, be mm-hmm. curious. And we've been fortunate enough to have that mindset carry through my life. And I was involved in heavily involved in two sports. But I also was in a fraternity, be that good or bad. But I also got involved in student government, was student mm-hmm. body president. So, mm-hmm. you know, everything from the bandwidth of athleticism to the Greek system to student government really gave me a sense of curiosity and diversity and probably how to maneuver, I think, somewhat carefully and respectfully through different perspectives. And I think that carried through a lot in life. And I really think that's probably one of the maybe lost traits many people don't have anymore.
Yeah, and we're going to get to prescriptions in a little bit, but I got to say, this transcends this. We've been talking about the liberal arts, but I think it's a calling of all higher education. The mm-hmm. things you talked about, those were leadership skills development and learning to be an engaged citizen. And so many voices from America's past, U.S. Grant, others saw that education isn't just about memorizing facts or picking up a skill. It's about becoming a citizen. Mm-hmm. And I think whenever we take a step away from that, it's chilling.
It is.
But it's there at every at community colleges do it. Huge research universities do it. And we have to encourage those young people in our family who are away at college to do what you did. Get involved.
You know, I think it's an interesting piece because it feels like society has swung. The cost of education has really questioned the value of education, mm-hmm. right? I mean, I spent 15 years on the board of COE, so I understand a lot of the dynamics. And I've been on the board of Palmer College of Chiropractic for quite a while. And so you just understand those dynamics. But I think the value, you know, the higher ed has almost moved or is getting societal pressure to teach more technically, right?
Yeah.
More
yeah.
skill-based.
Yeah.
And there's an understand of that, but I think that's really around trying to prove some sort of return on investment. Well, think about our liberal arts education each one of us had. And it taught us to think throughout our whole life. One set of skills today won't serve you based on the speed of movement in society 10 years from now, or certainly not 15 or 20 years from now mm-hmm. as you move through life. And so I still think there's a lot of value in what you're saying is how do we teach people how to think mm-hmm. rather than a set of skills?
Hmm. One of the questions put to that panel at the FIGGY was what will higher education look like in 2046, right? And one of the great observations, Dr. Calder, was, what was important for him and what he tries to seek for his students is discerning sense from nonsense, right? And mm-hmm. that's a tricky, tricky thing. Mm-hmm. And I want to get to that in just a little bit, but I also don't want to give short shrift to this amazing story of yours. So you came here, you joined this company. Was there a point at which you were like, it's here and I can see it there, that this vision came into focus?
Well, no.
Oh, okay.
It wasn't that clear, but it's a sum of the parts. Yeah. I mean, it was never a big broad vision. It was more around different experiences. My aunt was very involved in the company. They're a classic entrepreneurial story. He started the company. They were married in 70. They were married in 74, and she continued to work at her job as an actuary. But she would do the books at night on the on the card room table.
Wow.
And then finally in the mid 80s, she joined the company, but didn't draw a salary. And I say that my parents passed away pretty early, but I learned some great life values, but I learned wonderful business values from my aunt and uncle all my sort of business values at the foundation of that. And to your question, really, the whole idea here was more around, you know, almost a period of 3 to 4 years at a time, saying, well, could we be here? What could we do to grow? And what are the things, you know, that we can continue to advance? And how do we get a little bit better every day? Mm-hmm. So those were more of the ways we approached it rather than having this grand big vision. I think being ambitious is important for all of us. And I think ambition has gotten kind of a bad rap, right? Because so much that gets wrapped up today in our perception of that is self-promotion, as opposed to being ambitious for an organization, mm-hmm. whether mm-hmm. it's Augustana College, whether it's WVIK Radio, whether mm-hmm. it's our companies, our churches, whatever those are. But I think that I was always felt ambitious for the organization as how do we continue to grow and give great experiences both for the people we work for and the people that work for us.
Hmm. One thing I find fascinating, I've been at Augie a long time and colleges build, and I've seen that the various companies around here have been wonderful partners, including Estes. And I've had some representatives of other construction companies on the program, hope to have even more. Is this area distinctive? Because these are great companies, and you all are very competitive, mm-hmm. and you all work very hard, and I see incredible projects all over the place. Is it odd for a market this size to have so many great companies like that?
Well, I think it might be. I know that, you know, our biggest competitor is Russell Construction,
okay.
here in this market.
Yeah.
And I admire their company. They have made us be better. And Jim Russell would tell you, the founder would tell you, we've helped them get better. Yeah. The competition has raised the game. And it's healthy competition because you respect what the other competitor does. Now, both our companies do a lot more work outside of the Quad
yeah.
Cities
yeah.
than we do in the Quad Cities. Now, that's not a knock on the Quad Cities, but it's just the nature of how we've grown. And so, yeah, I think we've helped each other get better and stronger. But in different ways, you know, I like to say we're an apple and they might be an orange. Mm-hmm. And I think Jim mm-hmm. would agree with that.
Yeah. Well, that's an interesting image because I remember when Whitey's was on 16th Street in Moline and we'd ride our bikes over there. Right. And if that's where they stayed, it'd be fine with me, but probably not a good business plan. How many states are you active in?
Well, about six. Mm-hmm. We have 8 offices between Estes and then 2 other construction companies that we have acquired and left their identities in place. We like, if we're acquiring a company, we like to leave that identity in place and then build on it.
Yeah.
So it's about six different states we're actively working in right now.
Yeah.
And then we've traveled all over the U.S. with particular clients. And like right now, we're working in Colorado, Florida, Texas, Alabama, interestingly enough. And I'm probably missing a spot or two
okay.
outside of that.
Okay. Well, another thing that I respect about construction professionals is that it seems to go with the territory that you get really engaged in the community. I've seen you in so many things. Mm-hmm. I see people from Russell, McCarthy, mm-hmm. Bush, Valley Construction, on and mm-hmm. on and on, get involved in kind of the community development mm-hmm. side of things, not just economic, but in other ways too. Is that kind of an imperative with the game?
You know, I think it's important to do that because the foundation for the community is economic success and mm-hmm. and sort of social success. Right. Mm-hmm. And so one really feels like if we're going to have good companies, particularly based here, then we have to help the community be solid and grow.
Mm-hmm.
And certainly there's sort of a social duty to that anyhow, no matter mm-hmm. whether you're in construction or whether you're in manufacturing mm-hmm. or anything else. But I think in particular to construction, that's so the velocity is so dependent on success and economic development for construction companies that it becomes inherent. But I also think that at least the people in the companies you mentioned, they care about the community.
Yeah.
You know, several of them have grown up here mm-hmm. And they care about the community.
Yeah. Now, I know you've been on a million boards. And so I'm going to ask a very unfair question. I also have been on a couple, and there are some that are just, and it's, I think it's down to the individual more as much as the organization, but some of them sort of feed the spirit and mm-hmm. imagination more than others. And I'm just wondering, and I'll give you an out here, either a board you had served on mm-hmm. and still are fond of, and, or one that you're currently on, but are there favorites?
You know, I've learned a lot from all of those things, and I would discern that sort of two ways. One is I've learned the kind of things that I think I can add value to, right? Because you can't, we all can't add value to everything. And then also, does that give me energy? And so I sort of suggest that to people before you're invited on a board. Ask yourself, will being on that board give you energy? Because if you don't have energy, you can't contribute. And so no one needs a dud on a board, right? So I've taken that as sort of a filter. But more importantly, to your point, I've learned something from a lot of them. And probably one of the most impactful ones is the last 7 or 8 years I've been on the community Quad City Community Foundation board. And why that's impactful is it gives you a real breadth of so many organizations across the region.
Yeah.
And you get a really deep respect for organizations large and small and what they're trying to do. Now, you don't know them all, but what is impressive is the numbers of them. And many of them are grassroots, you know, just grassroots organizations, whether it's a church group, whether it's a group trying to, you know, better a neighborhood, whatever those are. Mm-hmm, and, you know, you see some of that with your public service in Rock Island, right?
Sure.
And it's and I think that's what makes a community great is when you see people taking those grassroots efforts, and they are doing it on the backs of their own energy and their own sort of commitment.
Yeah, one of my favorites of all time, and I'm just blanking on the name of the visionary woman who started this, but she started an organization called All God's Children Shall Have Socks.
Wow.
In Rock Island. Mm. And her primary focus was, you know, there's lots of things that are collected for people in need, and those are wonderful. But she saw that people were going without socks. Mm-hmm. And, you know, we take it for granted, right?
Yeah.
And so I said, Shirley, I'm just blanking for a second. But anyway, she's made that her mission and even set up a 501c3 to raise so that she can deliver socks to homeless shelters, to food pantries, all these kinds of things. And I've always been fascinated.
Have you
that.
Seen some others of those? I mean,
not that focused. Mm-hmm. I mean, and I really love that about her because one of the problems in the not-for-profit world is if you get mission drift and you're trying to do too many things, and you and I have both probably seen that. Mm-hmm. But just that laser focus, I always found very admirable.
Well, you know, I like the way you distinguish that because the one of the challenges is overlap, right?
Yeah.
We don't need more organizations overlapping with each other's. And, you know, you've been involved when we started Q2030, and I think one of the great things that we see now residing is this idea of with whom can we collaborate?
Yes.
And by collaborating, maybe we could build something bigger than each one of us could do individually.
Exactly. I really want to get into that a little more deeply with you. But any other boards here quickly before we take our break?
You know, I still really enjoy the Palmer College of Chiropractic Board. It's a national piece. Chiropractic was founded at Palmer. Vicki Palmer is still very active on the board, you know, the granddaughter of the founder. And they bring people in from all over the world. And we have campuses here and in Florida, and they're growing.
Mm-hmm.
And so it's been really exciting because we've been able to have a big impact on the college. And those are always, it's a very diverse group of people from around the country. There are about 15 board members. It's not a big board, but it's always, that one's very exciting.
And that's something that a lot of us don't pay enough attention to, but that's one of the ways that we are on the map globally. I mean, you can go to places, Southern California to Maine, and they know about Davenport, Iowa because of chiropractic. Well, my guest this week is Kent Pilcher from Estes Construction. We're going to come back to this conversation in a little bit, but this is one of those days when the weather's kind of the news. Right now, we've warmed up to 3 below in the Quad Cities, 9 below in Dubuque. There is still an advisory in effect until about noon. We've got a little bit of snow coming our way. Temperatures will stay very, very chilly, which means, friends, for us, we are going to stay nice and cozy. We'll be back in just a moment with Saturday Morning Live, portions recorded.
I'm Doug Stoker. WVIK is my connection to the world, so much so that I donated Ferguson, my beloved pickup truck, to WVIK.
From jobs to workplace culture to interest rate decisions, innovation, you depend on public radio and Marketplace to provide you with a better understanding of the economy and how it affects your money decisions. But we cannot do it alone. I got to tell you, we need your help to keep reporting. Here's how you do it, and thank you.
Thank you so much. Go to WVIK.org and look for the red donate button.
Hi. I'm Carol Glore from Savannah, Illinois, and WVIK is my NPR station. I get my news from WVIK, especially news of the economy on Marketplace every afternoon. And I also love classical music that WVIK plays.
Well, we love to hear from our listeners, especially on a nice chilly morning like this. My guest is Kent Pilcher from Estes Construction. And if you also like hanging out with WVIK listeners, I'm going to give you a little sneak preview here. But WVIK is going to get back into the travel business. When Don was the general manager, we used to take these theater trips to London and do all kinds of fun things like that. Well, Jared, our GM, Jared Johnson, is looking at doing a trip, the Christmas markets of the Danube next December. So we haven't released anything yet, but if you're listening right now and something like that sounds interesting, send an email to SML, that's right, Saturday Morning Live, SML at WVIK.org, and I will make sure you are on the list of notifications when we pull this thing together. But if Christmas markets of the Danube in December, what do you think, Kent? Does that sound interesting to you?
You know, it is. you know, it's interesting you say that. Germany's one of the favorite places in Europe that we visited. So it's, and knowing how well structured and how thoughtful WVIK is, I'm sure to be a stimulating trip.
Well, okay, so my connection with German is in eighth grade in Rock Island schools, you chose an elective if you wanted to for going into ninth grade in high school and everything. And my best friend at the time, his ma spoke Spanish. My ma spoke a little French. We wanted to be able to speak without our mothers knowing what we were saying. Mm. That was the only reason we chose German. He didn't stick with it. And somehow or another, I did. And so getting to do trips like this is a lot of fun and dust off the those old skills. But it kind of illustrates what we were talking about before. You never know where, you know, some of those youthful decisions will lead you. You mentioned Q2030 and some other things like that. I'd like to dig in a little bit. And in a few minutes, we're going to hear a great celebration of our community in Rock Island Lines. But efforts like that, you have these parochial, almost balkanized interests, as you would in any community of 400,000 people, but you multiply that with 25 different individual municipal designations, two counties, two entirely different states. How on earth does one try to approach consensus in a milieu like that?
Yeah, well, you know, it was interesting when we when that effort started, the idea was to create a regional vision. That was sort of the charge, but there wasn't any roadmap for that. And we had a group of us that was sort of anointed to do that. And as you know, your former president, Stephen Balls, is one of the co-chairs, along with Joe Slavens and myself, are tri-chairs. And it became real apparent, you know, there'd been a number of those kind of efforts in the past 30, 35 years that we'd lived in the community. And people would come up with plans. They would articulate a vision as a plan, and the plans, you know, we'd see sit on shelves and not much would happen. And really, the idea evolved that if it were going to be a vision, what would that vision be? Not the plan, but
right.
The vision.
Right.
And we said, really, the idea of working together. How do we think regionally? How do we act regionally? Because as you mentioned, with the math there, 25 municipalities, two states, there's been a long history of somewhat history of parochialism in our community, understandably so. So how do we break that down and say, well, we all thrive together? And how do we do that in a way that still protects the identity of those communities? And so we said our first mission has to be to sell an idea, not a plan, but an idea. And we spent about a year, about 14 months, marching around to a lot of different organizations, including municipal, educational, business, with the idea that would you just endorse this single statement, we're better to act regionally than individually. And how do we think regionally? And then we ask each one of those organizations if they'd be willing to give us a delegate to come together. And we asked that to be a stated endorsement by their boards or by their organizations. Mm. And we had 110 organizations, some large, some small, sign on for that. Mm-hmm. Well, we brought everyone together and say, okay, now how do we begin to put that into some ideas of how we make the area get better, right? And in the course of that, one of the things that emerged was a bit of a change in thinking. And so and we said, well, okay, how do we create a quad city identity, not so much prescriptively, but in terms of how people think. And someone came up with the idea of, let's think about New York. New York identifies itself as a region, but each of the boroughs still retains their own identity.
Right.
And so I think that was new thinking for the region and many people that are have a lot of community pride in their own individual, whether it's cities or neighborhoods, that we're really a texture or a series of fabrics, you know. And we started to help them think about that. And even further, another further illustration of that in play was we started talking about our biggest amenity is clearly the river, right? And it joins all the communities. And so we first started talking about a riverfront plan, and then it was interesting because I remember Dee Bremer, whom you would, you know, she was the county administrator and she'd been at the city.
Absolutely.
He said, you know, let's not try to create one plan. Let's take each community's plan and put it on a big map and say, this is our collective plan.
Yeah.
It was brilliant. Because it was a good example, I think, to the municipalities whose elected officials are elected to represent that local municipality, how we can manage this tension between not giving something up regionally, how we keep our own identities. And that helped us really move the thinking around and give people some examples of how through collaboration we can still maintain our identity yet impact the region in a collective way. You know, the old analogy, one and one make three, right? And so how do we make three out of this series of communities? Long story, but that's what we did.
And I really respect hearing that from you. And I got to say, I've been using that boroughs example for a long, long time. And it's more than just, and I've always thought that Rock Island is Brooklyn. Not just because I'm a Brooklyn Nets fan, and so just so you know, but I've had a chance to travel in New York, not a lot, but a little bit, and it's kind of like a young person visiting a college. I have hit all these really globally known highlights in Manhattan. I went to Staten Island, had a great meal. I went to Queens, Harlem, but walking around in Brooklyn with my spouse and my daughter Ashley and her hubby, I felt most comfortable once we, because we did the bridge, of course, walked over the bridge, and I'm walking around, and we went to a really funky bagel shop, and then went to an entrepreneurial chocolatier who's just started, and it happens to be two kids from Iowa City, by the way, Mast Chocolate, and I just felt comfy. Right. And so I base that on that, too. And I'll let the other cities decide who's Manhattan and who's Staten Island. But,
you know, I like your analogy for Rock Island. And, you know, I think that it's important that each of our communities sort of find that identity and lift it up with pride. You know, I see what Rock Island's doing in the downtown, right, as a way to kind of bring it back, bring the vibrancy back.
Yeah.
And so, you know, and momentum, as we all know, begets more momentum, right?
Sure.
And I think as much of one of the things that I always found interesting through the Q2030 journey was we got to interface with a lot of younger people who had moved into the community.
Yeah.
Like my wife and I did so many years ago. One of the things that we need to have is more swagger about our community.
Of course.
We have a great community, great place to live and work. And sometimes we don't appreciate that. You know, we take that for granted. And I think that if each of our municipalities can really say, okay, here's our swagger, now let's lay it all together in a quilt, so to speak.
Yeah, I think
off we go.
One of the things I think is the missing key, and it happens to all of the cities, is yes, the chip on the shoulder is great, the swagger, you know, Rocky Pride with the R-I emphasized has been part of, since I was in high school and even before. It's great, but you also have to give allowance to those people. That's not their cup of tea. And there's nothing wrong with that, but there's folks in, Borough B who wouldn't feel comfortable in Rock Island, and that's okay. But they have to understand that what we still have is a good thing. And we may not feel comfortable living in Borough F, G, or Y or anything like that. And that's where it breaks down sometimes is that there's this sort of implicit, almost sub rosa thinking that, well, mine is the best, so why should I have any interaction with the others? And I think that's where we break down.
Well, I do too, Kai. Yeah. I think that's a great insight because if we can elevate the thinking regionally, one of the things that can make this a great community, Quad City region, a great community, is those different textures. And while maybe as an example, One doesn't want to reside in Rock Island, but there are a lot of people that do, and having an option for them to reside in community X, Y, or Z is an important part of making this a bigger, growing, more a more diverse community. And I think in particular about Rock Island, you know, I think about so many people who have come to Rock Island, a lot of West African people. What a great, and I often thought, you know, what a great motto for Rock Island would be, a great place to start.
Oh yeah,
because many of them come here and they you know, they do baseline kind of tough jobs, and it's interesting to see them, many of them spring off.
Oh, the
and
entrepreneurship.
Use that and elevate. Oh, unbelievable. And they value an education. They have high, most of them have a high value of education. And I was down at, we were doing some work down at Smithfield Foods, and I wanted to go down in Monmouth. I wanted to go down and meet the plant manager, and I met him. And I asked him who's his biggest employment base, because my presumption was maybe it's the Hispanic community. He said, no, it's West Africans. And they commute down in cars from Rock Island. And he told stories. I had a meeting with him and the city manager who used to be from Moline, Lou Steinbrecher.
Yeah, sure.
And they told stories of people that had started at Smithfield Foods who'd opened up businesses in Monmouth. That became their upward mobility road. And I thought, what a great story, and what a great way to think of a community and support.
Well, we are going to talk more about this kind of stuff and leadership and everything else along the way, but it's important to know our stories. And for that, we always step aside, and this time we will as well, to Dr. Roald Tweet and Rock Island Lines.
This is Roald Tweet on Rock Island. Very few heroes apply for the job. Most, like the Rock Islander whose story this is, change the course of history not by sword and shield, but simply by reaching a point where they must stand up and be counted. In 1833, Dr. John Emerson of Missouri was assigned to the post of Army Surgeon at Fort Armstrong on Rock Island. He brought with him his personal attendant, a black slave named Dred Scott. Even though Illinois was technically a free state, legislators were quite loose in their definition of indentured servant. Remember that the slave Jim in Huckleberry Finn didn't dare simply cross the Mississippi from Missouri to Illinois for freedom. While stationed at the fort, Emerson and his servant lived in what is now Davenport, Iowa. There is some evidence that Dred Scott also lived for a time in a cabin on a land claim Emerson filed in what is now Bettendorf. Dr. Emerson was subsequently transferred to Fort Snelling near the future St. Paul for 2 years before he returned to Missouri along with his slave. Not until the master died in 1846 did the patient slave sue for his freedom in court on the grounds that he had been taken into free territory and therefore ought to be free. The case wound its way up through the courts for a decade. Finally, in 1857, the United States Supreme Court, by a vote of 7-2, made the earth-shaking decision that Negro slaves were not United States citizens and therefore could not sue for their freedom in court. The Supreme Court went even further and declared the Missouri Compromise unconstitutional on the grounds that Congress had no power to prohibit slavery in the territories. Today, only a small bronze plaque erected by the Daughters of the American Revolution at the site of Emerson's house, 217 2nd Street East in Davenport, records the important role we played in the story of the slave who stood up for his rights. Dred Scott lost, but that loss awakened slumbering abolitionists throughout the North and helped precipitate the great war between the states.
Rock Island Lines with Roald Tweet is underwritten by Augustana College, Rock Island, Illinois.
And it comes to you each and every week because folks just like you manage to find that big, bright red donate button at WVIK.org. If you are not a member and would like to become one, well, just think of all the wonderful things you're supporting by doing so, including Rock Island Lines. So you're listening to Saturday Morning Live, portions recorded. My guest is Kent Pilcher from Estes Construction, and we're kind of going all over the map, and I love that. So let's just keep doing that. Leadership. Right? Leadership, you've referenced that we have in our conversation a couple of different times. But the landscape in which leaders operate is constantly shifting. And the leaders that you and I saw in the 70s, their style wouldn't work now. Our style, to the whatever extent it might be effective, probably won't work in 5 years. Mm-hmm. What do you think about the qualities of leadership we need right now, whether it's from that Ghanaian entrepreneur that we were sort of obliquely referencing, or somebody who's lived their whole life? What do we need from leaders?
You know, we spoke earlier in the program about curiosity. And I think maybe if I had to summarize it, I'd say curiosity. I think a sense of a respect for others. And curiosity and the duality of not just being curious, but being really willing to engage in where the other person is, mm-hmm. and what's going through their mind, what's their perspective. We have a process we call dialogical inquiry. Actually, it was imparted on us from a friend of mine, Randy Richards, who was a professor, business professor at Ambrose for a long time, mm-hmm. did some work in our companies. And actually, interestingly enough, he was in the business department, but he had a PhD in philosophy. So, another good broad
you philosophers.
Yeah. And, but I think that sense of curiosity is really important. I think that sense of dignity for others, how do I help them get better, selflessness. You know, I hear a lot about servant leadership. I think that term in particular might be a little overused, but the idea of how can I help you? How can I help you get better? Mm-hmm. If you want to get better, mm-hmm. you know, because we can't impose our will of what we perceive to be better on them. We've mm-hmm. got to figure out what does that look like. And I think that, one of the things that we talk a lot about leadership in our company's developed some really unique systems and processes. We've actually trademarked them. But we're a talent development company and a leadership development company that happens to build buildings.
I love it.
And that's I think at the core of that is there's a humanistic component that goes right down to the individual and what do they want to be? And do they want to be a specialist and stay in their particular, I don't know, not everybody has to move up the rank, move right. up the organizational chart. Because right. quite frankly, as you know, it's pyramidal, it gets narrower at the top. Mm. But for those people that say, I really want to be a specialist, I want to be as good a technical person as there is, what's that pathway look like? And a lot of what we talk about and build in our systems is, the deeper we're in our career, we get a lot of technical experiences, but the real value comes in the soft skills and the leadership piece. And so if you really want to grow as a person, how do you grow those? You acquire the technical skills with experience, right? Mm-hmm. I mean, you can't mm-hmm. necessarily compress that. So I think back to the future leaders and I think about, well, there's some truisms here. You know, what will stay the same? What needs to stay the same? I think those are the things that need to stay the same. But there are things that need to be different. You know, the ability to embrace constructively artificial intelligence, mm-hmm, mm-hmm. The ability to think about diversity and bringing people together, whether it's, whether it's economically, whether it's ethnically, whatever that is, the ability to bring diverse groups together to create something better is going to be a really more and more important skill. Mm-hmm. So those are some of the things I think are going to be essential.
Yeah, and I think those are enduring. And I get a chance to see some of that close up in my day job across mm-hmm. the 38th Street here. But what's really, really fascinating is to encourage in these students, and I am sure for those risers and aspirants and seekers in your organization, that idea that you got to be open to the unforeseen at all times. There's a column in The Economist I like to read. It's called Bartleby, and it's broadly about human resources. And last week's was an amplification of the Peter Principle. Mm. And it's fascinating research. I mean, everyone might be familiar with that, but there was a guy named Peter, right? And he did some research. And what he found was that in sales groups, right? Well, this is the best salesperson. Let's make them the manager. And mm-hmm. it always failed. Well, not always, but it more often than not that failed because the person was not looking to do that mm-hmm. necessarily. They were really good where they were and being able to discern that. So I think that's something that, you and I in the chapters of leadership we're in now that we've got to be very cognizant of.
Well, we do. There's an author, John Maxwell, who's authored a lot of books on leadership and some are even good, Kai. But one particular example would fit yours. And he said this. He said, if you send ducks to eagle school, it frustrates the ducks and the eagles. And so we have to be careful not to try to put people in places where they don't want to be, or they don't aspire to, or they don't want to learn. So the ability, we, one of the things we talk a lot about is a fundamental thing from liberal arts, lifelong learning, how will you, we like to think we're learning organizations, how do we build that mindset in people? And as importantly, because learning doesn't have to be, it can be about anything, right?
Yeah.
And I think learning keeps us young. Yeah. I think about your good friend, Mr. Wooten.
Yeah.
And the way, you know, I still read a lot of his columns.
Yeah.
And the way, you know, the opportunity and kind of his mindset said through his columns about learning and that displays is that curiosity. But the idea is, okay, how do we really help you learn how to think? Not tell you what to do. How do we, you know, it's again another liberal arts concept, is how to think in situations, how to get comfortable. One of the biggest challenges we have in life is getting comfortable in ambiguity. And we have coined a saying, ambiguity amplifies anxiety. Now think about the case study, the wonderful case study to that phrase, not the experience, was COVID. When early in COVID, it was incredibly ambiguous. We didn't know from hour to hour, and then it became from day to day or maybe week to week. And the ability to navigate through ambiguity is really important.
Yeah.
And to not get too anxious with that, to get comfortable with not trying to get too far ahead of yourselves. Yeah. And oftentimes in ambiguity, there's a saying one of our people's fathers coined, don't borrow worry from the future.
Hey.
And it's a, you know, it's a mindset about let's deal with what we know now at the time. Let's be adaptable, right? Another liberal arts concept.
Yep.
And I think those are the kind of things that will be important in the future also is to deal with ambiguity, a lot of change, and to be flexible.
Well, I'm going to put you on the spot. What are you learning now? What are some things you're learning and curious about?
Well, you know, every day is a journey for me. Some of my learning is still formal. You know, my style is adapted to more, I'm a little less energetic about reading, still read a fair amount, but YouTube is a great source, you know, to get concepts from sometimes.
Yeah,
not social media for me, but YouTube.
Yeah.
And then also, I'm learning how to lead every day. I mean, there's no end game to this thing that says because you're in a position, you know, how do you adapt? How do you lead? How do you motivate people? Most importantly, how do you keep your energy up?
Yeah.
That's important because nobody, you know, remember the old Winnie the Pooh? The donkey was Eeyore.
Oh.
Nobody wants to follow Eeyore, right? Nobody wants to follow Eeyore. So the ability to make sure that how do we keep our energy levels up? How do we stay curious? And the deeper into your career, the more important that is.
Before we went on the air this morning, you shared that a new chapter in your life is being a grandpa. What's that teaching you?
Oh, my. I you know, it's hard for me to summarize that yet, but I can tell you the start of the journey is, it's as you and I discussed it, it's a switch. You know, we start to think very thoughtfully about what's our legacy want to be.
Yeah.
And not that we didn't have that with our children, right? But it's more around the idea, here's another generation. What will my legacy be to that person?
Yeah.
How can we help shape that person? Not control them, but shape them in a way of experiences. And I think it also draws us closer to our children. And so I'm, you know, we're learning about all of that. And more importantly, learning now at this point, early in your career, when you have children, their life comes at you 100 miles an hour.
Right.
And it's the analogy of drinking from the proverbial fire hose, right? And so you just, it's hard to be present because you got so many things coming at you, your marital relationship, your children, your career. And now it's, you can be more present and focused.
Yeah. You know, one thing that I often think is when we're parents, we are wired by evolution to be hyper concerned about keeping that gene alive. And in my case, my eldest child had a kind of a rough start. And so it brought that into very sharp focus. And it was, there were a lot of elbows in my life, right? That life was throwing at me. But then with grandchildren, and then if you're fortunate enough, you get to develop a relationship with an adult version of that infant, right? And that's a great thing. Trying not to let the baggage of seeing her at, you know, less than 3 pounds in my head, right? That's hard. But with the grandchildren, okay, mom, dad, you're responsible for survival. I get the fun zone.
Yeah,
it's very, very different.
I get all the fun, but they have to take take them when I'm tired of the fun. I think the other thing, you know, that just occurred to me as I thought about your question, my wife and I have talked about how proud we are of our son, our oldest son, yeah. because we didn't expect him to either want to have children, much less to be the kind of dad he's become or mm-hmm. becoming. And, you know, that's so there's this legacy piece. It's wonderful to see how are your own children adapting mm-hmm. to being mm-hmm. parents. Mm-hmm. And how are they loving and thinking about those experiences for their child?
Yeah, I don't mean to take this down, but I also think that, you know, I'm kind of the family genealogist after the others have departed the scene. And there's the reality that within a couple of generations, we're probably, our stories aren't going to be that relevant. Mm-hmm. But I have found great inspiration. I had a great grandmother named Amanda. And when she was 15, her father was killed in a work accident in Sweden. And her mother and the younger siblings all went to what is literally the poorhouse, where their services were farmed out to farmers, but the money went to the parish, right, to feed the poorhouse, right? Amanda at 15 said, that's not going to work. And so she set out and started hiring her own labor to local farms, made enough money to come to Northern Illinois, married another Swede, a guy named Svensson, right? And I never met her. She died in 1950. But the stories I've gotten from her and the things I've pieced together, she's a tremendous inspiration to me. And yeah, I don't think I'll ever leave a story like that, but it's something to keep you a little bit grounded.
You might be surprised, Kai. I mean, I think that, you know, you've narrated a wonderful gift that the previous generations passed on to you. And you might be surprised. One of the things I find, both my aunt and my uncle are deceased, and I find myself saying things they said.
Isn't that great?
And I think that we you know, you're a very humble person, but I think you've probably impacted people more than you might think. And I think there will be saying some things that you imparted upon them that may not be obvious today, right? But it sticks. Those funny kind of things, as I'm sure you can recall from, you know, your parental or your grandparent experience, yeah. And they stick. And all of a sudden, later on, they sort of pop out.
Well, as I often say, if I can't be an inspiration, let me at least be a cautionary tale. What are you looking forward to right now in your life?
You know, I'm looking forward to continuing to be a grandparent. Aww. There's a lot of good things going on in our three companies, a lot of great people. And I really enjoy seeing them be successful and get satisfaction. I am reading a really interesting book right now. We talked about that prior to the
show,
called Primal Intelligence.
Primal intelligence.
And it's in essence about it's about how they think the special forces train them to think. Mm-hmm. And this guy has studied and adapted the style. It's called VUCA. How do you think in volatility, uncertainty, complexity, and ambiguity?
Wow.
And, you know, when you think about the operations of a special forces person,
it's
moment by moment changing dynamic. But where that applies, I think, for all of us in life, you touched on earlier, the future is only going to get more uncertain. It's going to get more ambiguous. And so how do you adapt and learn some of the abilities to be comfortable in those situations? That's been a really interesting book because there's some real science applied to it.
Yeah.
And so one of the things I see people struggle with often is that ambiguity or that complexity.
Well, and of course, that eminent philosopher Mike Tyson once observed that your plan lasts until the first punch lands.
That's right.
And there have been some various.
He added a little more color to this narrative of that.
I think he did. Well, Kent, I can't thank you enough for being with us this morning. Before we go, you mentioned that great book. I'm always looking for fiction ideas, and I'm like you. It's the energy of my eyes rolling in the back of the head as soon as I start reading at night, right? Any good fiction you'd care to recommend?
You know, I'm more of a biographer than I am a fiction person.
I love it. But who's inspiring you lately?
Well, I hate to say this, James Madison's kind of interesting, and I'm not quite sure why I've been attracted to read a little bit about him. But I like the early leaders of the country. You know, some of them had different kind of paths, but the level of thinking and foresight they applied, you know, Jefferson, Washington, Madison, that they applied thinking forward and creating documents that have endured. And so how do we learn to think like that?
Yeah.
Now, you know, in today's, their lifestyle in today's world wouldn't be popular.
Right. No.
But takeaway, it's not so much about how they lived as much as how they thought.
Yeah. Well, we're going to have to leave it at that, and I can't believe it, but we're out of time. I want to thank my guest, Kent Pilcher from Estes Construction. Thank you for coming.
Well, Kai, this has been a delight.
And ahead on WVIK, it's Wait, Wait, Don't Tell Me. Be sure to join us next week when our guest will be Jessica Lenge Porter from Niobe Zoo about saving species all over the world. That'll be right here on Saturday Morning Live, Portions Recorded. You can find our podcast at WVIK.org or tune into Quad Cities NPR, WVIK 90.3 FM and HD in Rock Island, and 95.9 FM K240 DZ Dubuque.